Science is at a crossroads. Some academic scientists are feeling hamstrung by the growth of alternative science and pseudoscience journals and their inability to connect with larger conversations in society about the role of their work and the contribution the academy makes to this world. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Andrew Hoffman is professor of sustainable enterprise at the University of Michigan. His recent piece for the website The Conversation is titled Why the Web Has Challenged Scientists' Authority and Why They Need to Adapt. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning, Kate. Thank you.
Well, when it comes to trust in science and scientists and their work, where are we as a country in 2018?
Well, science is facing a crisis of relevance. The academy is facing a crisis of relevance. There are numerous surveys that show wide gaps between the consensus of scientific research and public opinion on issues like climate change and GMOs. And so a lot of people are choosing to reject what science has to tell us about the world around us. And that manifests itself in other ways, too. State governments are cutting funding for higher education. Wisconsin is one of those states. The federal government is threatening to cut funding for research. And so we have a new reality, and a big part of that is the rise of social media and how that changes people's access to information. And a scientific academy that doesn't really see it as their role to engage in public and political discourse.
Well, there's a lot to explore there. But when you say a crisis of relevance, what do you mean by that? Because the work these scientists do is very relevant to our world.
It's very relevant to our world, but a lot of it isn't getting out beyond the academic journals and the academic communities that they serve. And so that's what I mean by crisis of relevance, is the need for scientists and academics to take their good work and bring it out to the general public and the politicians that can use it. Right now, our reward system simply doesn't encourage us to do that.
Our reward system, what are some of the rewards for scientific achievement that are real benchmarks in the academy?
Well, every year, academics have to do an annual report. It usually falls into three categories: research, teaching, and service. And research is number one for R1 universities like the University of Michigan or the University of Wisconsin. And within that, it's the top-tier academic journals. Are you publishing in those? How many are you publishing? What are your citation counts? The metrics are all around engagement with our scientific communities, which in itself is not bad. But the fact that it just stops there, that there's no encouragement or training, for that matter, for academics to bring their work to the world, that is what needs to change.
Is peer-reviewed research an issue? Is that process holding back the academy?
No, it's not the peer review process itself, because, again, that will produce quality academic research. But the next step, what do you do with that? Right now, we produce academic papers, and then we move on to the next academic paper once it's done. But how do we take that work now and make it accessible to a general public who, quite frankly, is not going to go to our academic journals and read them? How can they find out what we're doing and have that inform them about some serious issues in our world today, and how can we use that to inform them in their voting patterns, and how can we use that to inform politicians as they develop policy? Or how can we use that to inform businesses as they set strategies or develop new products or services?
As you step back and look at this issue, how has the World Wide Web impacted this conversation?
Well, that's the thrust of this article. It's trying to say that there has been a technological change, one that is going to make permanent changes in how the public access information. And so with the web, people can now mine it for all kinds of scientific information of varying qualities, some good, some not so good. People are not very good discerning consumers of scientific information from the web. And that leads them to false ideas about their certain issues. Ask any doctor who meets with a patient and tells them their diagnosis and a treatment plan, and the patient coming back and saying, well, I have a different plan because I looked on WebMD. Ask anyone who's choosing not to vaccinate their children for autism or denies the science of climate change, and they will present you with quote-unquote scientific information that allows them to come to the conclusions that they have reached. And scientists need to do more to call out quality scientific process, quality scientific research, so that people can be more informed with legitimate and rigorous research when they develop their opinions on certain issues.
You also make a comparison to the current situation in science to what happened years ago, decades ago in the Catholic Church. What comparisons are you drawing there?
Well, the comparison I'm making is that in the printing press was developed in the mid-15th century by Gutenberg. And prior to the printing press, the only people that had access to the Bible were priests. And so people's understanding of what the Bible said came directly through priests. The printing press came along, and one of the first things that Gutenberg printed was the Bible. And so people now had access to the Bible. He also printed it in German, so they now had it in their own mother tongue. And then when the Reformation began, some 50 years later, Martin Luther used the printing press to great effect by producing pamphlets that had alternative views of what the Bible said to what the Catholic Church had to say. The Catholic Church responded by trying to shut down printing presses, question the legitimacy of these alternative views, and really try and resist the change that's going on. And the comparison I'm making here is that the web is now making academia and scientists one of many arbiters of what science has to say, just as now the Catholic Church is one of many arbiters of what the Gospels have to say, or what the Bible has to say. And I see many within academia either rejecting those with alternative views as illegitimate or resisting the changes that are going on, just as the Catholic Church did. And that the printing press created a permanent change in our culture. The web is doing the same. Resisting will not work. We need to adapt to a world where we are one of many arbiters of science with a privileged and important place. I'm not diminishing the role of science and scientists here. What I'm pushing for is the idea that we need to change what we do in terms of bringing it to a general public, that if they don't get it from us, they'll get it from somebody else to questionable goals and aims.
If you're just joining us, Andrew Hoffman is our guest. He's a professor of sustainable enterprise at the University of Michigan. Wrote a recent piece for the website The Conversation about how the web has challenged scientists' authority. How do you see the web having changed how we interact with science? Are scientists and academics keeping up? How can scientists best use technology to get their message across to regular people? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org, tweet us at WPR Mornings. Andrew, does science and scientific research still have a bit of an ivory tower reputation, grappling with something that is behind closed doors and out of reach to people who are not inside the academy?
Yes, it does. We produce papers for small academic communities, each with its own jargon and its own methodologies and theories. And again, that's not a bad thing. You have a group of people that have a common understanding, a common approach to a particular topic, but breaking down the ivory tower, eliminating the moat that surrounds it by encouraging more academics, not all, not everyone has to do this, but more have to do this to bring the work that's in those conversations to the general public, move it beyond the ivory tower.
So were academics too slow to embrace the web, or is it something else at work?
Well, I think that there is a reticence to do this because, again, the reward system is simply not there to do this. The tenure and review process, the annual review process, is really geared around academic publications. So those are the formal rewards, but also the informal rewards are there, too. There's something referred to as the Carl Sagan effect or the Carl Sagan syndrome. Carl Sagan was a a very influential astrophysicist, probably the most influential. And he was denied tenure and denied admission to the National Academies. And there's a certain dismissal that some within the Academy have for people who do engage in public and political discourse as somehow watering down science. They're hacks, they're popularizers. So that kind of informal reward needs to change as well.
Andrew Hoffman is on the morning show talking about the challenges that academic scientists face today. He's a professor of sustainable enterprise at the University of Michigan. As part of his article in The Conversation, he references a study from 2011 that found that many scientists do not believe it's their role to educate the public. What do you think? 800-642-1234. Back after this news. We're exploring the complexities of being a scientist today in an academic setting. University of Michigan's sustainable enterprise professor Andrew Hoffman, he references a survey from Pew Research in 2015 that found deep divides between scientists and citizens on a range of science, engineering, and technology issues. His article in The Conversation out this month is called "Why the Web Has Challenged Scientists' Authority and Why They Need to Adapt." You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are scientists and academics keeping up with how people regard and use their work and their findings? If you're a scientist, how do you connect with the public about your research? How do you translate your findings? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Andrew, you say that scientific research in the 21st century should find ways to break down the artificially narrow silos that have come to dominate academic life and link multiple disciplines in research. I thought we had gotten over the silo thing. What's happening there?
Oh, we haven't gotten over the silo thing. It's how we develop, you know, really deep, narrowly focused research, and it has some value. But I see some universities now trying to develop units that try and span the university to create linkages across the campus. Because the reality is that when we face major issues in our world, whatever they may be, they are multidisciplinary by nature. And so we need to bring the multiple disciplines together to find more sophisticated and more accurate studies, ways of approaching them. And I would also go beyond that, that we had once, you know, not just breaking down the silos within the university, but moving towards research programs that co-create knowledge with communities outside the academy, working with local communities, business, nonprofits, others that have some legitimate knowledge to bring to the research process.
So how would this change affect scientific understanding as a whole? And is there an appetite among academics to do this, to break down these barriers?
Well, it's challenging. It's very challenging because you can, as an academic, work with someone in another discipline. But then how do you publish that work? Our journals are discipline-focused as well. And again, coming back to the rewards, if I'm going to be rewarded at the end of the year for my publications in academic journals, and academic journals will not publish papers that are multidisciplinary or transdisciplinary, then I'm kind of in a bind. And this is where more senior professors, more full professors, those who have already gotten tenure, can start to lay the groundwork for their younger colleagues to create outlets, avenues, and legitimacy for this kind of work.
What do you mean by transdisciplinary?
Well, transdisciplinary, it's defined in many, many different ways. And you know, I apologize for this jargon, multidisciplinary, cross-disciplinary, transdisciplinary. It starts to get all confusing. But just think about it, one mode is just connecting the different disciplines within the university, and then the next mode would be then connecting it with people outside the university. And it's not, you know, this what we're talking about here is not simply academics going out and teaching the unvarnished masses. It's also working with people outside the university. And that's what we mean by transdisciplinary, working with people outside the university that bring important knowledge to bear. I do a lot of work with people in the corporate sector. They have a lot to say about the issues that I focus on. And in my opinion, they make my research better. And I think that we could do well to, as you say, break down the ivory tower by bringing other people in to the process of the knowledge creation that we do.
Andrew Hoffman, is it just enough to publish research these days, even in your scientific discipline, or does that paper or that finding or that whatever that thing that you publish, does it need a whole perhaps marketing plan rollout, a way of connecting with communities outside academia?
Yeah, I think a lot of my peers would bristle at the word marketing campaign.
I didn't know what other way to say it.
No, it's not entirely inaccurate. I think that's why some people, some academics, find this kind of activity somewhat distasteful because it sounds like self-promotion. But some universities, mine, does hire science writers to take the research that we produce and fashion it into either a press release or help the academic work it into an editorial to get it out there. The conversation, the platform that I use to write this, is a platform just for academics to write pieces, short, 700, 800, 1,000 words, that they have editors standing by and will help you clean them up and make them accessible, removing jargon, making it readable to the general public. It's like using a different language. And then some are good at doing it, some academics are good at doing it by themselves. And I would hasten to add, and some don't need to do this. Not everyone needs to be a public communicator. Some can't do it, some shouldn't do it. I know some people who are lousy communicators, but also some people are really focused on that basic research, and that's great because others stand on their shoulders when they produce their work. So this is about widening the tent, including different ways of fashioning what an academic can do and how they do it by being either more or less connected with the general public.
Let's go to Kenneth now, joining us from Janesville with a thought. Hi, Kenneth. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm wondering, if scientists have some responsibility for what has happened recently and that affected everybody. When they were saying that 1 year butter was good for you, and then saying the next year butter is bad for you, and 1 year saying fat's good for you, and then fat is not good for you, and people became disillusioned. And so, don't scientists have some responsibility to explain what's happening?
Kenneth, thank you so much. And it can be confusing, Andrew, the competing research out there and the different conclusions.
Mm-hmm. It's a legitimate concern. Science will produce work that comes to a conclusion, and the scientific process is designed for subsequent scientists to challenge what came before, test its accuracy, and perhaps come up with different conclusions. And there's a danger if scientists go too quickly to the public. But people have to accept that science at some times will change its decisions, change its position based on subsequent research. That doesn't mean you distrust all scientific research. And perhaps scientists could do a better job of putting in the conditions, the limitations of the work that they produce, and be careful, be reticent about laying out firm conclusions when there are perhaps some areas where they have to still work out some of the kinks. But I would caution people, yes, sometimes science changes its mind. There are certain issues where science is quite clear this is going on, and being able to tell the difference. And that's what I would come to, is that part of what scientists need to do is not just communicate the results of their work, but also explain, what is science doing? What is it capable of doing? How does it work? How does it come to the conclusions it does? And bring in the whole range of information that comes with scientific knowledge. In effect, trying to educate the general public on science, which surveys from the National Science Foundation and others show that most Americans do not understand science or the scientific process. And I think that that we have to sort of go back to basics now and start to take on a role of changing that, to educate the general public. This is how science works. And maybe if we demystify it, people will be less critical and less skeptical when scientists change their mind on certain issues.
University of Michigan's Andrew Hoffman is with us. He is a professor of sustainable enterprise. They're talking about the challenges that scientists in the academy face today. You can join the discussion, 800-642-1234. Do you see academia changing, or will this rift grow? Are you a scientist? Do you find it difficult to communicate your research and explain its validity to people outside the scientific world? Does that matter to you? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Andrew, you say that academics are up against a lot. There is rising tuition, perceptions of a liberal bias, charges that scientific research cannot be reproduced and thus verified, and then questions of the social value of much of academic research. So how do all those forces play together in what scientists are doing and producing day to day?
Well, you know, we live in an awkward time where people are less interested in debating your ideas and more interested in questioning your motives. And so when people have a legitimate concern or question about the academic enterprise, very often they'll shut down on other issues. I think we as a community need to face those issues head on and respond to them. We can't just brush them under the rug and try and address them. For example, bringing more conservatives to campus to speak is a criticism that is quite easy to address. There are, you know, many people that we could foster a broader debate from different viewpoints. Rising tuition, that is something that my university is trying to tackle. We've just done a fundraising campaign, and a major part of that is trying to bring down tuition costs through greater financial aid. So we need to recognize that just as your previous caller called in, that's a legitimate concern, the feeling of certain skepticism that, hey, you guys keep changing your mind. Why should I anchor myself on something you came out with today if you're going to change it tomorrow? If we start to explain more about how science works, then maybe that person would be more discerning on when science is, okay, we've got a certain degree of certainty here, much less over there, and be more thoughtful about what scientists have to offer.
There's also this reality that funding is just not there. Funding is drying up. The stakes are so high for scientists to bring in these grant dollars. Just getting and keeping an NIH grant today is very difficult. How does that play into this equation that scientists are in a brutally competitive marketplace?
That's certainly part of this. They have only 24 hours in a day, and a lot of them see the idea of engagement as adding to that work. I think there are ways that universities can lower that burden, if not eliminate it altogether, if they bring in science writers, if they have people that can work with them to communicate it. But also, I don't think it is an incredibly onerous workload to produce an article, a short article, that can go out to the general public that can explain their work. And in fact, in many ways, this kind of engagement can make our research better by testing our ideas out in the real world with people who are living the experience that we're studying, and then allow us to develop better research questions. Mm. And I would also add that I'm finding that the younger generation of scholars coming into academia have a much stronger desire to have impact in the real world than their more senior peers. And that holds out hope that they will change the academy. I think they're coming in such strong numbers that they will change the academy before the academy spits them out, where in prior years, if that's what you wanted to do, maybe you should go work for a nonprofit, but maybe you shouldn't be an academic.
How do you see social media factoring into all of this?
Well, it's a force, and I don't want to make this argument all about social media. It's one tool. To say say it's irrelevant is ignoring what's going on in the world right now. The president has certainly shown that the influence of Twitter is far greater than we ever thought. And interestingly, there's research coming out now that's showing that scientists are using social media. They are putting out essays as sort of trial balloons for ideas. They're putting out, there's research to show that the more an academic paper is tweeted, the more it's cited. You talked earlier about a marketing campaign, but a lot of scientists go to Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, these kind of social media platforms as ways to access information, access research by their peers. There is great potential for social media to be a constructive force. It has gotten used in certain ways that have been very destructive, but that doesn't mean it has to stay that way. And there is potential here for something really constructive to come out of this.
Some scientists would say that you expect me to do this research. It's like running a company on the side in addition to the teaching I'm doing in the classroom. And at the heart of this is the science that I'm really passionate about, that I really want to advance. How am I supposed to multitask like that? How am I supposed to be good at everything?
That's a very fair concern. And what I would like to see is more diversity in the kinds of ways that people can choose to be an academic scientist. And so if you want to be entirely in the lab producing academic work strictly for an academic audience, that's fine. If you want to be someone who produces work that has more of an applied bent and bring that work to a world that can use it, that's great too. Within all that, there are people who are rightly calling out that this singular focus on research, and singular may be too strong a word, but certainly when we do our annual reviews, when we go for promotion and tenure, it's research, teaching, and service, but it's research with a capital R. That's the dominant domain, teaching a little less so, and service at the bottom. And there are students who are saying, well, wait a minute, I'm paying a heck of a lot of tuition to come to this university, and I'm finding professors who are more focused on research than on educating me in the classroom. And their concerns are founded. And is it compromising the quality of the classroom education? But, you know, your point is well taken. Scientists have a lot on their plate already. How can we add one more thing? It will really only work if it's synergistic with their other activities, if it helps them be better in the classroom. And I certainly believe that being more applied and more connected to real-world issues and the real-world public that uses our research can make you better in the classroom in certain kinds of topics. And again, whether it makes your research better is also a different question. And, you know, will it get you cited more? And we can get down to just sort of straightforward furthering your own interests. If it gets you cited more, then it helps you achieve greater status and success within the academic endeavor.
Andrew Hoffman is our guest here on The Morning Show. He's a professor of sustainable enterprise at the University of Michigan, talking about the role of scientists today in academic settings and the challenges that they're facing. You can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. Do you see academia evolving? Do you see a divide between scientists and forces outside in society? If you're a scientist, is it difficult to communicate your research, explain its validity to people outside your world? And does that matter? Call in 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll pick up the conversation after a news update on the Ideas Network. A study by researchers at MIT published earlier this month in the journal Science analyzed the spread of 126,000 rumors tweeted by 3 million people over more than a decade, found that false news spreads faster than truth. Professor told the Wall Street Journal that they've reached epidemic levels of so-called information pollution and that we need to do something about it. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and the study is pertinent to the discussion with University of Michigan professor Andrew Hoffman as he writes about how academia is in the midst of this crisis of relevance. Getting your insights about what's happening to academia and scientists at 800-642-1234. How can scientists best use technology to get their message across to regular citizens? And if you're a scientist, how do you connect with the public about your research? Call in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Andrew, this study out of MIT was really eye-opening with all of these thousands of rumors then multiplying as tweeted by 3 million people, and you can really see the pervasiveness of how false information spreads. How does that impact scientists in the academy?
Well, you know, we've been talking about that study quite a bit, and it's very interesting. And to my mind, it highlights two things. One, we could do more research in understanding how social media works and how it affects our society and our public discourse. And that study has done that in a way that is really eye-opening, because the whole advent of social media is really the Wild West right now. We don't know how it works. We don't know what it does. Certainly the idea of influence and public discourse from outside forces is something that we're trying to understand. So just as a domain of research by itself would be a tremendous public service. And then, but then beyond that, you know, it can be discouraging for an academic to want to use this medium that has become so negative, that just focuses on the really base instincts of fear and outrage that seems to drive the spread of viral information. People are much more attracted to the negative than the positive, and I think that most scientists think that their work is positive. It has something constructive to say for the world around us. So the medium is certainly flawed. And again, I don't want to argue that social media is the only avenue or tool through which we should communicate our information. There are other ways as well, whether it's being on the radio show with you this morning or a press office putting out the details on that study out of MIT, or testifying in congressional testimony, or speaking at practitioner conferences, or at your local town hall, or at your local high school. Just getting out there and bringing the work to the people that can use it.
Back in 2016, you were researching and writing a lot about pseudoscience journals. Are they still an issue?
Yes, they are, very much so. I feel like I get an invitation once a week from a journal asking me to be an editor on topics I know nothing about. There are a lot, and this confuses the public, because it sure looks like an academic journal that came to a conclusion that confirms what I thought already. I'm going to grab onto that. And that, again, speaks to the need for people to be more discerning, and that's something that we're starting to grapple with in terms of higher education. Our job is being made more complex. We don't just, share information with our students, but we have to teach them how to be discerning consumers of what they find on the web. And I see that young people are starting to shift on this. A student may present an idea, and then someone will come back, well, where did you get that? And the conversation then becomes not only about the content, but the validity of the source of that content. Mm. And that has to be part of our shifting social discourse.
Let's go to Gary now, joining us from Ripon. Hi, Gary.
Hi. This is a very interesting thing to me, and I'm not in the academic world, but I had two points. One is you referred to the world outside of science as the real world. I wish scientists would stop doing that. Science is just as real as anything else, and they shouldn't always be apologizing for the existence. But the second thing that goes along with that is that I think the case of Galileo and the Catholic Church is a better example. I'm not a Catholic, but Galileo told them basically the truth, but they had other reasons for not wanting to believe that or go along with that, and I think the world is still like that. I just don't think science can really change that.
Gary, thanks. Andrew, your thoughts on that?
Well, the first point is well taken. I'm chuckling because it does further the divide when we think of ourselves as separate from the world around us, and that's the real world and we're not. So the point well taken. The second one is interesting because, when people are presented with information that challenges their beliefs or their behavior, the response is to resist it. People reject science that challenges their worldview and then readily accept it when it confirms it. And I think that is at play in our world today. People with so much information at their fingertips, literally at their fingertips on their computer, will seek out information that solidifies their belief in the world around them. And when Galileo presented information that challenges the worldview of not just the Catholic Church, but the people within it, they resisted it for a whole host of reasons, one challenging the supremacy of the Catholic Church. People are doing that today, and they do it in a whole host of ways, and social media does further that activity, that tendency. Who you choose as your Facebook followers, who you choose as your Twitter followers, typically have a common worldview with you, and therefore they will provide you with information that reaffirms your worldview, and you'll do the same for them. And how do we break that down and allow people to access information that is challenging? Because any kind of learning is about being challenged. But, what you thought was true is no longer true. And social media allows us to hide in these little bubbles and stick with information that makes us feel comfortable. And so that element of the Galileo example is certainly valid.
Gary, thanks for the call. John in Boaz is here. Hi, John.
Hi, I am a scientist. Back at GE, we were developing the WAN and the LAN networking, wide area networks, local area networks. We had an email going at 1985. But let's not forget about Martin Luther. He nailed his thesis 500 years ago. And, of course, he didn't have his First Amendment right. Bad news travels fast. And I feel propaganda started the hideous World War II. Specifically Goebbels and that. But I think that to make things fair, I ended up being a building inspector. We need to be licensed. If I tell you your roof leaks, I have to be certified to tell you the honest truth. Now, I think media should be certified, licensed, Constitutional Amendment 1A.
John, thanks so much for the call. Andrew, a lot of different thoughts going on there. Isn't bad news travels fast, though?
Mm-hmm. And that anyone can be a content provider. I'm not sure we're going to be able to move towards the direction of licensing all content providers. I am a content provider when I put information on the conversation. That's what social media did. It broke down the gatekeepers. No longer did you have reporters and editors that could sort out good from bad information and provide it to us. Now, any information can hit the web, and off it goes, and people will grab onto something. The more salacious, the better. We're going to have to come to terms with this and come to grips with this to start to understand it. Certainly, there are questions. Maybe it's not going to be the government certifying media providers, but certainly there's tremendous pressure on groups like Facebook to start to police the information that comes across their web page, hold them liable for the information that they are helping spread. So maybe that does speak to the caller's concern that there is some kind of accountability that seems to be starting to emerge for content providers to be more conscientious and more rigorous in the information that they share and the damage they can do by sharing controversial or destructive information.
Andrew, as we've been talking about the importance of connecting scientific research to broader issues in society, in the moments that we have left for this discussion, are you starting to see some examples of what you're talking about in action, some glimmers of hope?
Yeah, there are glimmers of hope. First of all, a lot of academics are starting to get involved with social media, are starting to communicate more effectively outside the university. And there are groups. The American Sociological Association produced a report on how tenure and promotion committees might consider public engagement. The Mayo Clinic has added social media to its annual review process. Mm. And there are other things happening where, the National Academy of Sciences has had colloquia on how scientists need to better communicate their information. There are universities that are starting to develop programs. The Science and Society program at Northwestern, there's a program at the University of Massachusetts. Alan Alda has kicked in money at Stony Brook for the Center for Communicating Science. So it does seem to be catching on. And there's a really nice quote from the Mayo Clinic, if I may. When they announced that they're going to use social media in their annual review, they had a line here, and it's towards healthcare providers, but it could be towards any scientist. And he says, "The moral and societal duty of an academic healthcare provider is to advance science, improve the care of his or her patients, and share knowledge. A very important part of this role requires physicians to participate in public debate, responsibly influence opinion, and help our patients navigate the complexities of healthcare. As clinical educators, our job is not to create knowledge obscura, trapped in ivory towers, and only accessible to the enlightened. The knowledge we create and manage needs to impact our communities." And I think that speaks to the challenge quite nicely.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Kate. It was a pleasure.
Andrew Hoffman is professor of sustainable enterprise at the University of Michigan. His recent piece for the website The Conversation is titled "Why the Web Has Challenged Scientists' Authority and Why They Need to Adapt." This hour of The Morning Show was produced by Chris Molina and Nyasia Ellison. Michael Deringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation comes to you on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening.